Not the alcoholic. This is Dean. I'm going to do steps 10 and 11. I'll do 10. And just for a few minutes, I'd like to talk about step 10. I continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. The first thing I think of when I say that step out loud is when I was living with my wife, we went out to dinner. I'm still living with my wife. Before she was my wife, we went out to dinner at this nice restaurant, and we were sitting there talking and just really happy. And I'm telling her this story about something that happened when I was on the road, and I realized that most of the story wasn't true. It's just a story I'd been telling for years. And I'm looking at this person who I just purely love and who just accepts me exactly as I am. And I'm starting to close down inside, realizing I just told her this is just a joke. It was a lie. And I thought, well, I'll find a time to tell her that that wasn't true. And this voice in my head kept saying, promptly admit it. Promptly admit it. And I stopped and I said, hey, I just got to tell you that that whole story I told you about George and me and that whole I don't even know if that, I don't think that ever happened, and it certainly never happened to me. And I just lied to you. And I was embarrassed, and I didn't want her to think less of me. And she laughed and she said, you don't think people do that all the time? She said, it's okay. And it was just one of those little gifts of being an AA. And I won't lie to you. Every time I catch myself doing that, I don't tell people that. I just, you know, I'm just telling you that's what, when I think of this step, that promptly admitted it thing. And it paid dividends because I didn't have to suffer with the thought, oh God, and make it bigger than it was. And she just accepts me and knows humans are humans. But that was a direct result of being involved in these steps and having that 10 steps so clearly in my head. The other thing is, for a long time in my sobriety, I was a salesman in the field, and I had to go, I got a chance to, because in Los Angeles there's a lot of meetings at lunchtimes in restaurants. So you can go at noon to 1, and I found a bunch of men's stag meetings that I would go to, and these guys were just lots of old timers, and Milton there, and Bob Horgan. But one guy I really respected, who was a therapist actually, he said, you know, just try writing a 10 step every night. Why don't you try writing a 10 step? And I would hear that and think, boy, I should really try that. And then I wouldn't do it. And after about a year of him saying that, I went and got the book out and looked at all the questions when we retire at night. What do we look at? And I wrote the questions down, and I printed them on my computer, and I made a little folder. And I did it for a week. I wanted to do it for a month, but I did it for a week. And I'll tell you what my experience was, is when really writing a 10-step, and I don't want to ruin the experience for you, I recommend you do it, was that every page was the same. Every day. The thing I did the day before, I did again the next day. I was short with my children, or I was impatient with my wife, or I cut corners at work so that I could do what I wanted to do and do the fun stuff at work and not the hard stuff at work. And what was good about that, and we mentioned the phrase yesterday, is it rose above the horizon line what my continual hamster wheel character defects were, what it was I did every day. And it becomes harder to do them when you know you're going to write about them that night and look at them again. And it also becomes freeing over time, because even though I stopped doing it after a week, these things were pretty pronounced in me, and I could see them. And just saying it today, I think I might want to take another crack at that, but... that's just my experience with that step, is the promptly admitted part seems super valuable, and the actual doing it every night and making yourself write it, because I don't know about you guys, but it's kind of like praying. I pray every night. I prayed every night since the day I got sober, on my knees. And we're about to get into that, but I have to tell you this story. So I dated my wife for a while, and she's just lovely and beautiful, beautiful woman, and we went to a concert, and that night, she kept kind of stalling, like I wasn't leaving. So I realized I was probably going to spend the night with my wife for the first time. And she went into the bathroom when we were going to bed, and I, I realized I had to pray because I pray every night, and I would feel weird if I didn't. So I got down on my knees to pray, and she came back, like worst scenario, she walks back in the room, and she looks at me and she goes, "Are you praying for that which I'm about to receive?" I'm And I said, "Yes, I am." And I've done it every night since then. So that's off the topic, but I think I'm done.
That is the topic. That is the topic.
Can I comment on something about the 10 step?
Absolutely.
Before you go, just quickly. The 10 step to me, if what happened to us when we got sober is we were awakened, the rest of the journey is to take that awakening and turn it into some kind of an awareness where I'm actually aware that I'm awake and maybe there's something I can do with this. And the 10 step talks about the continuing inventory process. And there's a difference between self-obsession and self-awareness. And in the 10th step, I think, is when we really begin to develop the self-awareness, where we're watching ourselves move through life in such a way that we're not obsessed about what we're doing, but just as Matthew described, when you catch yourself in the middle of doing something, that's awareness. You catch yourself. I mean, you're watching yourself. You're not obsessing on it. You're just paying attention, living an examined life. And many of the spiritual teachers talk about this, living an examined life. And that's what happens in AA. And I think that's specifically what the 10th step is about, is living this examined life. I was speaking one time and my wife was with me. And after the talk, and I was aware that I did this. I pretend like I wasn't aware, but she says to me, "Weren't you in the mental institution twice?" And I said, "Well, yeah." And she says, "Then why do you say a few times?" And I go, "What do you mean?" She goes, "A few is more than two." And I just felt like smacking her. And I've never said that since. But I knew we all fabricate. We all have a tendency to expand a little bit. That's a common thing. But there's a lot of other behavior traits. Like one time I was at work, and the way I would treat people, when I told about how Jay said it's who you are that people don't like. It's not so much what you say, but how you say it. This is very true for me. And I was sitting, I had gotten into it with somebody that worked for me, and I came around and I was sitting at this desk, and I got a clear vision. I mean, there's no other way to describe it, of what I look like when I'm looming over somebody and telling them what they need to hear, And I had this vision of how I look, and it startled me. It was like, whoa, And I think that's awareness. I mean, you can't have that kind of thing without knowing that something's wrong and having that weigh on you. And then something will happen and to cause you to see what it is you're doing. And that's the beginning of the end of it. It may not end right away, but it is the beginning of the end once you're conscious of it. And that's the 10th step to me.
The 10th step for me has changed over the years. I mean, I was brought up with religious self-examination, which it even says in the book, this is not supposed to be, morbid reflection. And try asking, or try sitting down and looking at the spiritual qualities that you possess and reflect upon how you go through your day and how those are reflected. Try doing that for a week and see what kind of a being you've become. Try doing it every few years. And you can see how you grow along spiritual lines, because when we come in, you know, that's what we are. We're I drunk away my soul. I was an animal. But the 10th step, living the examined life, is also about, okay, now, you know, I was leading a retreat a while ago, and this guy came in, and he was really having a tough time. He was helping his father transition, and his father had been sober in AA for a long, long time, and this guy had always had a flexible sobriety date, and just filled with remorse and guilt. And he said, you know, my father was not a very good father. He said, but he was 15% better of a father than his father was. And he said, I may not be a very great dad, he said, but I'm 15% better a father than my dad was. Three generations, 45% swing. And, you know, at 2 years sober, generosity of spirit may not be my guiding principle. But at five, you know, and generosity of spirit is the only thing that is the spiritual line that I'm seeking to grow along. It's the only thing that makes sense to me. So I want to talk a little bit about technology and the 11th step. I have a beautiful singing bowl at home that I use, but recently there was, when we started all getting, how many of you have smartphones? Okay. All right. So, Jim, I'm sorry if you feel excluded, but there's an app called Insight Timer, and this app, what it does is it has a variety of singing bowls on it. It costs $3, and then it allows you to choose the time for your meditation. So you don't have to watch the clock. It allows you to set what tones you like. It's got like a bunch of different tones. It allows you to journal your meditations if you so desire. And you can also even secretly encrypt them so your significant other can not see that you were meditating about Pamela Anderson when you were... and then another wonderful thing about this app is that one of the great lines is that where two or more are gathered, there I am. I being the Spirit. With this timer at the bottom, there's a little app, and you can go in through your Facebook, and I know that this is just... I don't enjoy Facebook much. I play with it a little bit. These boys are very, very adept at it. But what happens is...
You've got to keep track of people.
Yeah. Exactly. But what this allows you to do is that when you sit down to meditate and you hit this, if you sign in through your Facebook, it actually... will put that JS in Redondo Beach is meditating. And when I go to sit down and I hit this thing, I can look, and there are people all over the world now that I've been meditating with for months and months since I got this app. And I say, oh, there they are. And then it's even got a thing with your friends where you can, oh, you know, Alan was meditating with me today. And all that kind of stuff. So it's, again, it's this odd way of using technology as community. Now, Bill, of course, what he does is he just puts it for 2 hours and then walks away and, you know, watches Animal Planet and comes back and says...
As opposed to Facebook, people think I'm really spiritual.
Yeah.
But I'll make amends later.
Yeah. Promptly.
Promptly.
And it'll be universal, which is great. Universal amends are really fun. So this is a...
That's not true about me, by the way.
Still early. So this is an app that everybody I know that gets it, they end up meditating a little bit more than they were before. in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that if circumstances warrant, we invite our wives or friends to join us in morning meditation. Now, has anybody here ever had a warrant? A warrant? Yeah, I mean, like, it's kind of serious stuff, right? So that's not a mild term. And again, back to this thing of where two or more are gathered. And that the difference between, the main difference for me between marriage number one and version 2.0, it is an upgrade. It is severe.
I'm on 3.0.
Overachiever.
But that Adele and I an identified goal of ours before we got together was that we were going to be spiritually supportive. That was the most important thing that we were going to do. And so we were praying and meditating together before we slept together. And it's a wonderful thing. So I want to show you guys, because it's one thing to talk about it, but Sarah's going to come and help me out here.
This is version 2.1 now.
So you can tell your friends when you went home, why should you go on a retreat? I saw a spiritual surrogate. So when we get up in the morning, now we just go hang out on the couch. That's a wonderful thing I do. And when we started out meditating, it was hilarious because I have 10 more years than my dad was on. She's going to be 22 in another few weeks. And since I was a sober man, I thought of the way that we should meditate and pray. So I did that for about 3 or 4 days. And after the fourth day, she said, you know, this really isn't getting it for me. And what I heard her say is, I don't like the way you kiss. That's not what she said. That's what I heard. And so I reacted in my magnanimous fashion. It's okay, darling. Come on. You will lead the meditation. No big deal. And so the next morning, we went and did things the way she felt comfortable doing it. And then I waited over maybe 8 or 10 minutes, you know, just to let things settle afterwards. And started to share with her exactly where she was not maybe quite as enveloped as I was in the habits of life. She left for work. And, you know, I always tell people, you know, why would you ever date anybody that was not in the fellowship? I mean, because the sponsor always takes the bullet before you get it, you know? And so I called her. I promptly admitted it. You know, I called her about 20 minutes later and said, God, I was really a bunch of assholes. Boy, I'm really sorry for that. And ever since, we've been meditating just about every day together. And what happens is, on the days that we don't, occasionally I forget who my wife is. And my wife is my dearest friend, my greatest supporter, the person who wants better for me than I can possibly imagine. And I'll treat her like some other feminine form from earlier in my life, by which nobody should be treated like that. You know, so, but we find that when we, on the days that we meditate, we don't get those kind of little snippy comments. That doesn't mean that I don't make mistakes, but, you know. So anyway, what we do is we do the 3 minutes sit, just like we did a moment ago. And then when we come out of the meditation, you can use any form of prayer, but the St. Francis one is a great one to start with. And so what we do is, this is like the marching orders for the day. And to be able to look at your loved one in the eye and say,
Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace.
Where there is hatred,
let me sow love.
And where there is injury,
pardon.
And where there is despair,
hope.
And where there is darkness,
light.
And where there is sadness,
joy.
O divine master, grant that I may not so much seek to console, to be consoled as to console.
To be understood as to understand.
To be loved as to love.
For it is in giving that we receive.
And it is in pardoning that we pardon.
And it is in dying that we are born to eternal life. And then I kiss her, and I run off, and we go on to the bread. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But if you want a sober home, this is what's in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's not some weirdness from the left coast that's right to tune in.
It is weirdness from the left.
Ladies!
This is the leader of the call. Come to spread the word.
So anyway, the other thing that's about that is that, okay, so you're not fortunate enough to be sharing a home with a significant other. But if you've got roommates are the source of conflict. Meditate together anymore.
Men don't do that.
No. You'd be amazed before, you know, what happens if you meditate together. You don't have to read into each other's eyes, but if you don't have roommates, if you have a dog. My cat comes and sits with me frequently, but you know, my daughter, after my family dissolved, and when my daughter would come and spend time with me, I had her hold the timer, because I used to use the kitchen timer. And so she, you know, when she was 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, she'd hold the timer so that we were together during that. And there's something that happens, you know, and it doesn't happen if you don't do it. It's not like I'm being punished. It's no, I haven't. All consciousness is opening. All consciousness is invitation. All consciousness is awareness. And if I just want to jump up and go into my day, that's what I'm going to get. But if I want, I can have the love that animates the universe walk with me and help direct me, and so that when I walk down the street, I'm looking for where it is that I can make conscious contact with my fellows. Kill your television set. If you want to grow spiritually, exponentially, quickly, kill your television set. Because all it tells you is that you aren't thin enough, you don't have enough money, and you aren't buying the right shit. Just an opinion, but yeah. I'm right, and... See, they don't... They ain't going for that one. Another thing about the 11th step is that there are certain areas in the country where... Or not certain areas. That's not true. There are certain people who have the opinion that Alcoholics Anonymous would be more effective if we embrace the Christian roots of the movement. And they talk about the founders and what went on in Akron, and they say that we have hijacked the movement and walked away from it. My friend Mr. Cleveland and I, excuse me, the three of us do this workshop where we go through this thing called the Akron Manual. And in 1940, Dr. Bob said, boys, the big book's written above the blue-collar level. We need to get some pamphlets so that the local guys can, the blue-collar guys can understand what's going on. Something simple, something direct. And so there were four things. There were two Akron manuals. There was a thing called A Speaker's Guide to Alcoholics Anonymous
that's very, very wonderful, except Bill and I and Matthew will never put it into action because it says be brief.
That must be wrong.
And then another of these pamphlets that came out in 1940, 1941 was called Spiritual Milestones in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, this is out of Akron, supposedly the Christian bulwark of Alcoholics Anonymous and where the true consciousness is, some people say it. And I just want to read you what it was, and Bob was very involved in this. The spiritual life is by no means a Christian monopoly. There is not an ethical religion in the world today that does not teach to a great extent the principles of love, charity, and goodwill. Followers of Muhammad are taught to help the poor, give shelter to the homeless and the traveler, and to conduct themselves with personal dignity. Consider the eight-part program laid down in Buddhism. Right view, right aim, right speech, right action, right living, right effort, right mindedness, right contemplation. The Buddhist philosophy, as exemplified by these 8 points, could be literally adopted by AA as a substitute for or an addition to the 12 steps. How's that for a little heresy? Generosity, universal love, and welfare of others rather than considerations of self are basic to Buddhism. So, just so you know, from the very gate, they were saying, bring it all on. Try it all. And it's fun because I keep finding other weird things as I go down the path. And then I wanted to talk about an experience that changed my life last year, about a year ago. And it had to do with Matthew at our 11-step meeting. Do you want to lead off? Or
I was traveling a lot, and you know, sometimes having parents like this is a bummer. You know, just an example of that is when Bill tells you that your sponsees teach about your character defects, and then you call to complain about your sponsees, and halfway through the conversation, you just hang up and go, "I know." So Jay is, you know, Jay and I have wandered this path a lot together, and we've wandered off in different directions. I've done meditation retreats, and we did centering prayer for a while, and we have an 11-step meeting that's been a part of our recovery, and Jay's been very close to, and Bill has, and I went back to. But as last year, I got a promotion, and I started traveling. I was in hotels 165 days, and all over the country. And I was trying to learn a job that I thought was a little stretch for me. And, you know, we were doing more of this stuff, so the weekends were sucked up. I was incredibly feeling guilty about my family. But I was losing my practice of meditation. And it was because when you're in a hotel and you're going to get to work at 8, the real work you do is at 6 to get ready for work, you know, in my job. And I have to show up prepared, and I confessed at the meeting. I said, I'm having a problem. I'm very thin. I'm solid ground, and I haven't been meditating at all, and I can feel it in my life, and I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed by my family, and I'm overwhelmed by you people, and I'm overwhelmed by my job. So then Jay.
I've been there. And instead of coming up and kicking him in the ass, telling him what he wasn't doing, giving him the nice Jesuit approach.
Yeah. Guilt, I know. I said guilt.
A guilt-seeking missile. But I just walked up to him and I said, "How can I help you? I want whatever it is, whatever, because my schedule is completely flexible. How can I help you? I said, is there a time that we can get together? And he said, okay, 6:30 in the morning. Well, I didn't really want to get up at 6:30.
How else can I help you?
Yeah.
7:30.
Yeah, we had a bargain.
And so we started getting up, and we got on the phone, and I just call him, and we'd be quiet for 10 minutes together on the telephone. Because consciousness is transmittable. You know, it works really well like this too, you know, just knowing that they're there. But on the discipline of having the phone really kept me disciplined. And
I want to interject.
Yeah.
And so I'm in these strange hotels in different places, and I just agreed that that's a good idea, Jay, let's do that. And what we would do is we just use our cell phones on speakerphone, and knowing he was there added to my consciousness. I did it because I wanted to, you know, there's a certain amount I want to make sure Jay's going to get up, so I got to get up, and we kept each other straight. Yeah. But knowing he was there, and then we would just end with, we'd say, thank you and I love you, and hang up, and it had a huge effect on my day, on my family, on my job, on my head. So I just wanted to, because I know where you're going to go, I just wanted to say the first aid was immediately effective.
Yeah, and by 2 weeks, we both knew that there was something really wonderful that was going on. You know, this is practical. You know, you just heard the results. First day, but 2 weeks later, it's really practical. Within a month, what's coming across my heart is, we got to share this. You know, that's just the kind of guy I am. I've got a conference call number for a business thing, and so I said, okay, we'll go and we'll put the conference call number out to people and just invite them to. So from 6:30 to 7:30, I'll be there meditating. So now, because I've been nice to him, I've made a commitment, and now I'm up to an hour. Now, I've never meditated for an hour straight in my life, except a couple of times when I was on long directed retreats. And yet, I've made a commitment to do this. My wife, who is looking askance at me about all this, starts joining me. We start having more fun. I start putting little orange sticky papers out, and then I got the cards done and all that stuff, and we just invite people to get in the spiritual jacuzzi. And so there's an hour, nobody says anything, you know, they just dial in. And you know, it's 2, it's 3, it's 4, it's 8. Sometimes, I think the most we've ever had is like 20. But, you know, one time I'm on my way to do research at Stepping Stones. I have the guy that I'm driving with, Bill Schaber, pull off the road because we got to meditate.
Emergency meditation.
Traveling with me is daunting on a number of levels. But anyway, and so we do that, and there was a woman that called in from Paris that day, and a woman that called in from Buenos Aires. You know, and I mean, it's just like, so that's what's going on, is that my life, all that I did was walk up to somebody that had a problem that I had. An idea that I figured out to try and make him better. I'm coming up to share with him, and suddenly I'm going for an hour. Then, in June last year, my wife comes home from her sponsor with a spiritual book. She's always coming home with a spiritual book, you know, from her sponsor. I mean, and being a sober man, I will pick the book up and I'll look at it and set it down and say, that's wonderful. Go off into my day. And so anyway, I pick this book up and I read three paragraphs. She says I'm lying. She says she doesn't even think that I actually read more than two sentences. But the voice clearly said to me, do this. The voice doesn't talk to me directly like that much. But it said, do this. And so I
walked over and I got on the computer and I looked this teacher up and I downloaded a couple of his talks and listened to some stuff and I liked it, and then I joined a class, and after a couple of weeks, I was really meditating even more, and I was off on a new enthusiasm. And sent a little email and said, you want to come lead a retreat in Los Angeles? And he said, love to.
And he's in Great Britain.
Yeah, in Hampshire, England. So he comes, stays at my house for a couple weeks, gets to meet all my friends, and leads a couple retreats, and he ends up, actually a couple weeks ago, moving to Southern California. He's living a mile and a half from my home. What is that? All I did was walk across the room and say, I don't want you to have to suffer, because I've done it. So, that's it.
Can I share
something? Yeah, of course. I'm going to take a coffee.
We say things in Alcoholics Anonymous, we say, my head is out to get me. And so we talk about it in the third person, this thinking mind. Usually because we're alcoholics and we feed on negative energy, we make it a battle. You know, it's an adversarial relationship, you know. My head's like a bad neighborhood, don't go in there alone. That there's something evil about it. There's something, it's trying to get me, it's trying to set me up. You know, and so we spend a lot of time trying to change its thinking so that it thinks about better things, more positive things. We say things like, you can't think your way into better living, but you can act your way into better thinking. And in meditation, we can all have the experience of watching our thoughts. The focus of it, as Jay says so well, is not to have a blank mind. I mean, it's the nature of the mind to think. That's what it does. It's not the enemy. It's not trying to hurt us. I jokingly say it's trying to help. It's just stupid.
It's a great line. It's a great line.
Yeah.
It really is.
It just takes the past and projects it into the future. And it can only exist in the past or in the future, this ego of mine. That's what it's communicating with me. I have no sense that I'm separate from it. I believe it's who I am. It thinks these awful thoughts, and I feel guilty about it. You know, it'll think all kinds of stuff. You know, it will plot murdering children on a playground, and immediately I think, God, I've got serial killer tendencies. Any minute now, I'm going to walk out on a playground with an AK-47 and just mow down innocent children. You know, and you're going to read about me in the paper. You know, and we mull on this stuff, and we get depressed, and we get down, and we think it's who we are. I have certainly thought that what was going on in my head is who I am. This, if you ever find out what I'm thinking, you'll reject me and you won't love me because of this stuff that runs in my head. In meditation, as you attempt to be in the present moment, to me what the goal is, if you could even call it that, is to try to be right here, right now. One of the simplest meditations I've run across is you sit in a chair and feel the chair holding you up. Just focus on the chair holding you up so that your head and your ass are in the same place one time during the day. That's about as blue collar as it gets. You know, that's all I'm looking for, you know. I'm not wanting to astral project. I've done that. I've taken a lot of acid, you know. I've been there and I've watched myself from afar. You know, I get it. Right now what I'm looking for is I want my head and my ass in the same place. 3 minutes. I'm up to five, you know. And so what happens is I'm sitting there watching my breath or feeling the chair hold me up. And my egoic mind, this mind of mine, wanders off into the other room. And it's thinking about something else, unbeknownst to me. Just, and there I am. I'm not feeling the chair. But I catch it. I catch it. I recognize that it's thinking about hot rods. Boobs is a good one, you know. And sometimes I think, well, we'll just stay there for a while. It's not a bad one, you know. But I catch it. I recognize that it's gone. And I bring it back. Who's catching it? Who is that that's catching it? I don't know. But I know one thing for an absolute fact, a verifiable fact. It proves that I am not my thinking mind. That changes the whole game. I'm no longer a victim of it anymore. I'm on to it. I'm on to it. I get it. Now, it doesn't like to be observed. It gets all weird and stuff when you watch it. There's these, you'll start twitching and shit. It's you know.
Cannot compute.
Yeah, it can't compute. It can't deal with it. When you catch it and you bring it back to the breath, you are now exactly in the present moment. And there is nothing for this mechanism to do now. There's nothing for it to do. In the past, it can interpret for you past events. That's why people say there's my story and then there's what really happened. Because my past, all the years I spent in psychotherapy, I'm telling them what I think happened. I'm not really sure about what happened when you get right down to it. It's been proven to me over the years that my recollection of what occurred in the past is off. Because I'm taking it all personal. It's from a personal perspective. So this thing will interpret those things in the past and then we mull it over. Or it projects into the future, which is completely unknown. It absolutely doesn't exist. It can't possibly exist. And I'm projecting into the future about the way things are going to be, what's going to happen. And it has something to do there because it can interpret for me. But you bring it into the present moment and it just slinks away off into the bushes. When you start looking at it, it goes away. So, feelings of anxiety, feelings of depression, any kind of disturbance that I may have, in that present moment, those things go away. Now, they come back. They come back. I can't sit there in the present moment all the time. But while I'm there, everything is absolutely as it should be. It could not possibly be any different than it is. It is just what it is. And there is no moral judgment on it. It is just the way that it is. There's nothing wrong. It couldn't possibly be anything wrong. I'm right here, right now. And all of this stops. It stops. That changes the whole game. Everything's different now. Now, I recognize and I understand at depth that I don't have to change this thing. I don't have to analyze it. I don't have to mull it over. I don't have to work on it and cause it to be different in any way. I can simply ignore it. When it comes up with one of its good ideas, like, let's kill them all and then kill ourselves. You know, what do you say? Seems like a good idea, you know? They're the source of all of our consternation. You know? I can just ignore it. Go, yeah, talk to you later. I don't have to think about it. I don't have to go, oh, God, why would I think that horrible thought? What is wrong with me that I would go there? It just does what it does. It just grinds on stuff. It just, that's what it does. I walk out into the backyard, and I stub my toe. And it hurts. I mean, it hurts. I sit down, I hold my toe. It might even be bleeding. And I go, damn! Now, this egoic mind creates nothing. It creates absolutely nothing. It's essentially kind of useless, actually. But it creates nothing. It just takes credit for stuff. I mean, it's part of who I am, so in that sense, it is not incorrect. It's part of the human experience. It's not an error. It's there for some reason. It develops around 2.5 years old. You can see it in small children. You know, first they feel connected to you, they feel no separation, and suddenly they separate. We have a name for it. We call it the terrible twos. But here this thing is, it's part of me. So it notices the stubbed toe. The fool stubbed his toe. You know, and it, then it tells me stuff like, well, if you weren't so fat and stupid, you wouldn't have stubbed your toe. You've always been kind of uncoordinated. You never could play football. You tried, but you know, you couldn't really cut it, you know, and no, and it just goes like this. And now, on top of the pain of the stubbed toe, I have suffering. Now the stubbed toe, the pain of the stubbed toe will go away. The suffering hangs on. It waits around for me to stub my toe again because I know how clumsy and stupid I am. And now on top of everything else, I'm old. You know, and it's just going to be like this. There's going to be one stub toe after another. You know. Is any of that real? No. None of it's real. Yet we believe it. We buy into it. The only thing I've been able to discover is in the meditative process, in sitting and trying to just be quiet and be in the present moment, I discover that I'm not my thinking mind. A few years ago, I was really sick and I was depressed. And a friend brought me a book and he said, read this. He actually yelled at me.
He's French.
He's French.
Yeah.
Therefore, he's an asshole. Actually, to be correct about that, he's Parisian.
Oh, yeah. He wouldn't like that. Yeah.
The Parisians are real assholes.
So, but I'm just explaining why he yelled at you.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's the book that his sponsor insisted that he read 4 years before.
Yeah. Well, you kind of...
That's kind of true.
He didn't yell in French at you.
He didn't yell at French. Yeah. He just rolled his eyes. And I read it. And I've read a lot of books like that. And I know stuff in my head. And I can repeat it back to you. And that's my motivation for reading spiritual literature, so that I can repeat it back to you and sound very spiritual. There's no depth to it at all.
That's what it used to be like.
Yeah. This time, because I'm sick and I'm depressed, I read it with intent. I'm looking for an answer. I need some help because I'm swirling down the drain. And I really felt like it was the end for me in some sort of a psychic way. I mean, it just, this is how it's going to be. I was buying into the thought process. And I read the book. And in the book, Mr. Tolle tells the story of being in his apartment in Vancouver, and he's suffering from anxiety, he's suicidal, he's a mess, he's educated, but he's just a mess. He's living alone, which he doesn't like, and there's nothing's going right in his life. And he wakes up in the middle of the night one more time with an anxiety attack, and he walks out in the living room and he says, I can't live with myself any longer. Then the very next thought is, well, then there must be two of me. If I can't live with myself, there must be two. And the very next thought is, I wonder which one is real. When I read that, that's us. That's all of us. This internal struggle that goes on. This thing. And we're trying so diligently to be good people. And then we fail. And we once again prove to ourselves that we're worthless, that we're not good enough, that we don't measure up. And we all battle with this. I mean, I spent a lot of years trying to make a name for myself in an anonymous organization. What the hell is that? You know? Now, I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's really weird. And why would I do this? What, you know, what's going on with me? This. I'm not good enough. I need the awards. I need something. I need recognition. I need devotees. I need something. In meditation, I understand. I don't separate myself from it because I already am separate. I just can't see it. It's like we've talked earlier about character defects. Once I can see them, it's the beginning of the end of it. Once I sat in meditation with intent and had the experience of catching my thoughts, of being the watcher, and coming back to focus and coming back to the present moment, it changed my life. It changed my life. It changed my perspective on life.
It made things a lot easier for all of us.
It pulled me out of the depression. What happens to us and what happened to me is I was ill and I became Bill the sick guy. I became that. I listened to what this was telling me and I became that. When this changed, this relationship to this changed, it did not change my illness. But I'm no longer Bill the sick guy. I'm no longer Bill the old guy. You know, I'm much more than those things. It isn't all that I am. Even if I am sick, it is not all that I am. He loves to say meditation is not extra credit. It's part of the step, and there's a very good reason for that. I mean, this experience alone, this can change your life and the way you see the world around you. It's a major aspect of the psychic change. It's very real, and everyone can have it. There's no, it isn't. You don't have to be special to do this. You can sit and watch your thoughts. Thank you.
So just to give you a little paragraph of the literature about the rewards of it, and then I need to make an announcement. The greatest rewards of meditation, this is from the 12 and 12, page 105. The greatest rewards of meditation and prayer is that sense of belonging that Bill just discussed, actually, that comes to us. We no longer live in a completely hostile world. We are no longer lost and frightened and purposeless. The moment we catch even a glimpse of God's will is the moment we begin to see truth, justice, and love as the real and eternal things in life. I just love the 12 and 12. Hey, I'm a little embarrassed to say this, but you know those gay shorts I wear, the capri pants? I lost a pair here, and they're tan, light tan are the ones I were wearing. If anybody's found them, or I don't know how I could possibly, my room is 5 feet by 5 feet, and I lost these pair of pants. But if you guys see them or find them, can
there
was
some clothes by a tree?
I don't know what that's about. I knew I was leading with my chin. Okay. So out there? I'll go look out there, but if anybody's packing and sees them or doesn't know, just I'm an E6, just leave them in front of my room.
So we could go on ad infinitum about this. We've got a lot of really wonderful things that we would love to share with you, but I think we should have a break and come back at 11 o'clock and finish this thing off.
Absolutely. Okay.